This is Kirk Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule. Or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
So who's with me tonight?
We've got Sonia and Henry, the husband and wife team, and then we'll hear Sandra, Tom, Anna, Chris, and Lindsay. Sonia's going to start off this show with a story called 9/11.
A True New York Story, as told to S.E. Schlosser. As a special treat, we decided to take the sunset cruise around Lower Manhattan the Sunday before Labor Day. It was a silly thing to do, totally tourist, but sometimes playing tourist is fun, even for someone living and working daily in the shadow of the Big Apple. We took our cameras, my husband and I, and oohed and awed over Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty. We gawked as we went under the huge Brooklyn Bridge and held hands as the sun set in the west, turning Lower Manhattan a lovely golden glow. As dusk fell, the lights came on, and that was glorious, too. We were on the East River now, between Brooklyn and Lower Manhattan. I sighed happily, gazing at the beautiful glow of the Twin Towers that made up the bulk of the World Trade Center. Then I blinked suddenly in surprise. I saw a large silhouette of what looked like a jet airliner flying toward the North Tower. A moment later, it intersected with the tower and disappeared. Then a second silhouette, also of a large airplane, appeared from the opposite direction and flew right toward the South Tower and vanished. I shook my head in astonishment, and goosebumps rose on my arms and legs. What the heck had I just seen? I rubbed my eyes, but the New York skyline was back to normal. I shivered, and my husband noticed it at once. Turning away from the magnificent glitter of lights, he asked, "Are you okay?" "I am fine," I said shortly, brushing both question and strange occurrence away. I couldn't explain it and didn't want to think about it. "Wow, look at that," my husband cried, pointing upriver. Thrusting away the strange appearance of the two planes by the Twin Towers, I obediently gazed upriver and drifted back into tourist mode. A few days later, I was vacuuming the living room after breakfast when the phone rang. It was my husband. "Turn on the television right now," he said, knowing I rarely watched TV in the morning. His voice sounded strange. I grabbed the remote control and switched on the television. Immediately, the screen was filled with a picture of the World Trade Center towers, black smoke billowing up around them. "Two planes just hit the towers," my husband's voice said in the phone I had tucked into my ear as the newscaster's voice told me the same thing. Together, over the phone, we watched our separate newscasts as rescuers tried to get to the people trapped on the upper floors. And then there was a sudden rumble, and first one, and then a second tower collapse. All those people inside, I thought in horror, knowing I had just seen hundreds of real people with real lives die in an instant. My stomach roiled, and I sat abruptly down on the couch, horrified beyond even tears, my body shaking. "Oh, my God," I prayed and stopped, not knowing what else to say. Suddenly, I remembered the vision I had seen Labor Day weekend. The memory brought with it all the chills and goosebumps it had when I saw it. Oh, my gosh, had my vision somehow caused this? My body shuddered with fear and reaction. But no, how could it? I'd seen a vision of disaster, what my grandmother called a forerunner. But I still wasn't prepared for the chaos I saw on the screen in front of me. This is not your fault, I told myself firmly. Taking up the remote control, I turned up the volume and watched events unfolding in the city and wondered where the terrible events of today would take us. What day was it anyway? I wondered abruptly. I glanced suddenly over at the kitchen calendar. The date burned itself into my mind. It was September 11th, 2001.
Ghosts of Ringwood Manor, a New Jersey ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. Ringwood Manor, you say? A lovely old house, but no place, my child, to go on a dark night with no moon. Built in the 1700s, the original house was a collection of small buildings, patched together to create a manor. The current manor house was built by Martin Ryerson in 1807. Ringwood Manor was the home of General Erskine, who ran the ironworks. General Erskine was a geographer and surveyor general for General George Washington during the Revolutionary War. What does that mean? It means, dear, that he made maps. General Erskine died of pneumonia during the war and was buried at the manor. Ringwood Manor overlooks a small pond. It is surrounded by truly lovely grounds, which are perfect for a ramble in the daytime. But at night? Well, love, it is at night that the ghosts walk. Where? My, you are curious, child. Well, there are three different places that are said to be haunted. If you wander the halls of the manor house at night, you might meet the ghost of a housemaid who haunts a small bedroom in the second floor. They say she was beaten to death in this room. Whether there is any truth to it, I don't know. But my friends tell me they have heard noises coming from the empty room. Footsteps, sounds of heavy objects dropping, soft crying. And they keep finding the bedroom door ajar and the bed rumpled. The other ghosts? Well, back behind the manor pond is the grave where General Erskine is buried. The local people are afraid to come to this place because at dusk, General Erskine can be seen sitting on the grave, gazing across the pond. And it is said there is an unmarked grave filled with the remains of French soldiers who fought with Rochambeau during the Revolutionary War. During the day, all you can see is depression in the grass near the general's grave. But after dark, the dead come to the manor pond to walk along the shore. Sometimes you can hear soft, sad voices speaking in French. So go ahead and visit Ringwood Manor. Ramble its lovely grounds and explore all you want. Just be sure to be home before dark.
Dancing with the Devil, a Texas ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. The girl hurried through her schoolwork as fast as she could. It was the night of the high school dance, along about 70 years ago in the town of Kingsville, Texas. The girl was so excited about the dance. She had bought a brand new sparkly red dress. She knew she looked smashing in it. It was going to be the best evening of her life. Then her mother came in the house, looking pale and determined. "You are not going to that dance," her mother said. "But why?" the girl asked her mother. "I've just been talking to the preacher. He says the dance is going to be for the devil." "You are absolutely forbidden to go," her mother said. The girl nodded as if she accepted her mother's words, but she was determined to go to the dance. As soon as her mother was busy, she put on her brand new red dress and ran down to the Casey Hall where the dance was being held. As soon as she walked into the room, all the guys turned to look at her. She was startled by all the attention, Normally, no one noticed her. Her mother sometimes accused her of being too awkward to get a boyfriend. But she was not awkward that night. The boys in her class were fighting with each other to dance with her. Later, she broke away from the crowd and went to the table to get some punch to drink. She heard a sudden hush. The music stopped. When she turned, she saw a handsome man with jet black hair and clothes standing next to her. "Dance with me," he said. She managed to stammer a yes, completely stunned by this gorgeous man. He led her out on the dance floor. The music sprang up at once. She found herself dancing better than she had ever danced before. They were the center of attention. Then the man spun her around and around. She gasped for breath, trying to step out of the spin. But he spun her faster and faster. Her feet felt hot. The floor seemed to melt under her. He spun her even faster. She was spinning so fast that a cloud of dust flew up around them both so that they were hidden from the crowd. When the dust settled, the girl was gone. The man in black bowed once to the crowd and disappeared. The devil had come to his party, and he had spun the girl all the way to hell.
Four Chaps in the Library by Paul Bradshaw. In the process of recalling my college days, I am reminded of that momentous occasion during my first year at St. Montague's when, by some irksome and malign fate, I discovered myself sharing the confines of the school library with three well-read scholars of that time. These loathsome fellows I normally would avoid at all costs, but owing to the atrocious February weather, I was compelled to gain a welcome warmth beside that roaring fire. "What is your name, young chap?" I was asked by a large scholar wearing a three-piece suit of pinstripes. His inquiry wore a ghastly cloak of supposed superiority and rank, which I kind of expected, as I was a mere first-year student at that particular time. "Grimshaw," I told him, and as I uttered my name, I surveyed the three pairs of beady eyes which were fixed upon my being. I detected a vast amount of arrogance beyond those staring sockets. "A common name," sneered the fellow, whose own name I knew to be Rhodes Fotheringham. As I have mentioned, he was large, with a reddened, chubby face, and whiskers that hid his stiff upper lip completely. It appeared as if he owned the bottom one only, and I reckoned this to be quite comical, although I dared not to chuckle in their presence. "Well, Grimshaw," snarled a second chap, whose name was Blake, and who was exactly as tiresome as Rhodes Fotheringham, "my chums and I were in the process of recounting horrific tales of ghosts and apparitions. If you wish to remain in our company, you must endure this." "And not go fleeing from the room in fright," added the third monster, a scoundrel by the name of Atkinson. I endeavored not to be afraid, which was not a simple task, as the trio themselves were sufficient to cause a shivering sensation inside me. We were all seated, with discreet distances between each, in huge Victorian armchairs facing the blazing flames of the log fire. The library itself was enormous and must have contained thousands of books on all subjects, including the topic of ghosts. "I remember one chap," said Rhodes Fotheringham, a cigar of eager proportions in his ample hand, "whose name I cannot recall. He regularly encountered the ghostly figure of an old man in a pale-colored nightgown who was prone to walking up and down the stairs of the chap's home, and with his head held under his arm." Excessive gasps left the mouths of Blake and Atkinson, whilst I remained silent and breathless. Rhodes Fotheringham's features became hidden in the midst of an awful-smelling cloud of cigar smoke, providing an eerie vision of his face, and at that moment I wondered whether he himself was a dreadful phantom. "Anyway," he continued, with the smoke drifting in the direction of the fireplace, "this chap could stand it no longer, and subsequently decided to take his own life by shooting himself in the head with a pistol. Now it is rumored that he himself haunts that house." His two companions seemed quite unsettled by the story, and as the flames crackled in the hearth, they each took a copious amount of the brandy that was readily available nearby. Then Blake appeared to decide that he was not to be outdone by his friend.
"That is a pretty gruesome tale, old chap," he said in a quavering voice. "But allow me to relate the story of the man whose wife gave birth to an apparition." "By Jove!" exclaimed Rhodes Fotheringham, with peculiar puffed cheeks. He appeared to be somewhat perturbed by Blake's proclamation, and I noticed how agitated he became as his companion continued the tale. "It is indeed true," said Blake, who in contrast to Rhodes Fotheringham was of a thin shape and was clutching his brandy glass tightly the whole time. "This apparition grew to a fine old age, until he reached a maturity he could not improve on, and now he haunts the church in which his parents had married." Again a strange air filled the room, and an odd nervousness prevailed in the three figures that flanked me. I remember thinking how chilling and sinister were those three fellows, to the point where I began to feel rather frightened myself. However, I attempted not to reveal this, as I sat with clenched fists upon that armchair, gazing into the leaping flames opposite my position in that library. "That is an impressive story," said Atkinson. "I had never seen a chap as tall and gangly as he was. His weird-looking legs protruded from that chair, stretched out before him like two huge clothes props, and behind his gold-rimmed spectacles I observed the most evil pair of gray eyes. "What about this, then, chaps?" he said, grasping the opportunity to tell his own grotesque tale. "A soldier in the Great War was lurking in the trenches, with bullets whizzing around his ears, when suddenly he noticed beside him his own ghost. It was identical in every detail, and he was naturally astonished. Seconds later, this poor chap was struck in the head by an enemy shot and was killed instantly. But strangely, he recalls then holding his own dying figure in his arms, for he had taken over the form of the apparition that was beside him." "My good God!" cried Rhodes Fotheringham with an obvious alarm. I then looked at Blake, who appeared so petrified he was speechless. I found it quite odd that these three chaps knew so much about ghosts. They seemed to be more than mere students of the college, and indeed I morbidly started to fear what exactly they were. However, I quickly dismissed these thoughts and seized the chance to reveal some ideas of my own. "This is all preposterous," I shouted above the blaze of the fire. "What?" demanded Blake, who suddenly regained his powers of speech upon hearing my unwelcome exclamation. "I have never half who saw the ghost on the stairs. How do you know this is to be shot himself?" "The same with the soldier in the war. He was dead just seconds after supposedly seeing his own ghost, so how do you know this? And as for the fellow whose wife gave birth to a phantom, that is pure drivel of the finest water." Rhodes Fotheringham was in such an intolerable rage that I thought he would explode before my eyes, and the other two were not far behind in their ire. Each of them was blazing more intensely than the fire was. "Get out of here," yelled Rhodes Fotheringham in a tremendous booming voice, "and do not return. You are far from worthy of our company." This request, or rather this command, seemed quite popular amongst the three of them, and so it was with a trembling demeanor that I proceeded to leave the library. A chilling silence ensued as I slowly stepped away from them in the fireplace. However, I believe I succeeded in astounding my trio of companions, for I departed from that room without opening the door.
Going Courting, a Colorado ghost story as retold by S.E. Schlosser. Jay Dawson had two goals in life, to find a rich vein of gold and to find a bride. So far, he hadn't had any luck with either the gold or the ladies. His smooth eastern manners seemed rather sissy and irritating among the rough miners and rowdy residents of a wild western town. He courted the schoolteacher, the local farmer's daughters, and even took to visiting a few of the entertainers at the saloon, all to no avail. Then one day, Jay Dawson's lifeless body was found at the bottom of a cliff. He had fallen several hundred feet off the mountain, where he was prospecting for gold. He was buried in Buckskin Cemetery with a small service. 2 days later, the sheriff found the body of Jay Dawson in the local saloon, lying in the bed of a lady of the evening, whom he had courted a few months back. She had been sleeping off another busy night when she awoke to find Jay Dawson beside her. The sheriff calmed the hysterical woman and took Jay Dawson back to the graveyard to bury him again. Naturally, no one knew anything. The miners avowed their innocence, and the shopkeepers and businessmen claimed their ignorance. The town treated the matter as a joke, speculating privately on who had dug up poor old Jay Dawson. 3 days later, Jay Dawson was found at the schoolhouse. He was propped against the doorpost, a love note addressed to the teacher in his hand. After being dead a week, he was not a pretty sight. The sheriff removed the corpse a second time and had the body buried as deeply as possible. He piled heavy stones atop the grave, and Jay Dawson remained in his grave for several weeks. Then came a spate of activity. Jay Dawson was found sitting on the porch of the local advocate's house, clutching flowers with a note addressed to the eldest daughter. Next, he was found sitting on his favorite bar stool with a box of sweets addressed to one of the pretty lady entertainers. He visited several prosperous businessmen's daughters with love letters and bouquets of wildflowers. Finally, the sheriff hired a couple of local boys to watch the grave. One night, one of the boys roused the sheriff from his bed. "He came up out of the grave, I swear. It was Jay Dawson. He came out of the grave and started picking wildflowers." The boy was hysterical and wouldn't calm down till the sheriff went to the graveyard and saw for himself that the grave had been disturbed. The next morning, the sheriff found the rotting corpse at the home of his own sweetheart, and that was the last straw. "I have had enough of his shenanigans," the sheriff said. "If he is going to behave like he belongs in a cesspool, then that is where he belongs." The sheriff grabbed the moldering body of Jay Dawson and dragged it down the road to an old outhouse that stood near an abandoned shanty town. He tore down the outhouse and buried Jay Dawson in the remaining muck. And that was the last time anyone ever saw Jay Dawson. His courting days were truly behind him.
The Brother's Revenge, a Wisconsin ghost story, retold by S. A. Schlosser. The blizzard was raging fiercely around them as the brothers stumbled down the long road. They were miles from any farm, and they knew they had to seek shelter or freeze to death. So it was with gratitude that the two brothers spotted a saloon and pushed their way through the door. Every eye in the room turned upon them as the boys ordered coffee with the last of their money. As the bartender went to fetch the hot drink, most of the regulars returned to their conversations, but one man continued to stare. A massive butcher with a mop of red hair and a long red beard, who was the worse for drink. "You're looking at me funny," the butcher slurred, looming over the two boys. "We weren't looking at you," said the older boy. "We were just warming ourselves by the fire." "Are you calling me a liar?" he shouted. Around the room, crowd grinned. They loved a good fight. "We didn't say that," said the older boy quickly, waving his hands and accidentally striking the butcher on the arm. That did it. The butcher grabbed the boy by the collar. "No one hits me and gets away with it," he roared, and threw the boy head first into the huge fire raging in the hearth. There was a moment of stunned silence in the saloon, and then the elder boy screamed in agony as the flames engulfed him from head to toe. The younger lad shouted in terror. The older boy stumbled out of the fireplace as the little brother tried to beat out the flames with his small hands. The butcher loomed above them, grinning sadistically as the flaming boy lost consciousness, his screams dying away. "Your turn," the butcher said to his brother. The younger boy gasped in fear and fled for his life out in the raging snow. The boy's little frozen body was not found until the spring. One evening, a decade after the death of the two young boys, a burly man with a long red beard came strolling down the road, one taken by the brothers. The butcher had heard rumors of a ghost, but had discarded them as so much poppycock and tavern talk. As he meandered down the road, he became aware that a silence had fallen. In the odd silence, he heard the footsteps of a large animal. They walked when he walked, and stopped when he stopped, pulse pounding madly. The butcher turned. Behind him, large as an ox, stood a black dog with blazing blue eyes and sharp teeth. The butcher had seen those blue eyes once before, gazing at him from the face of a young boy trying to save his burning brother.
The black dog growled softly and took a step forward. The butcher whirled around to flee and found himself face to face with a tall figure covered from head to toe in flames. The burning boy reached out toward the butcher with hands withered and blackened by fire. The butcher gave a terrified scream and fell, blood gushing from eyes and nose. He was dead before he hit the ground. To this day, the black dog and the flaming figure still appear in that vicinity to harass travelers and speed them on their way.
Palatine, a Rhode Island ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. The Palatine gleamed in the sunlight as she set out with a full crew, a long list of passengers, and a hull full of merchandise for the American colonies in the winter of 1750 to 1751. Certainly, there was no indication that morning of the destiny fate had in store for her. It was not until the first of the storms blew the ship off course that the passengers began to sense the trouble brewing under the surface between the captain and his crew. By the time the storms had ended, the captain was dead, murdered by his crew, and the passengers were prisoners. During the days which followed, the sailors forced the passengers to pay exorbitant prices for a bit of bread and some water to drink. One morning, the passengers awoke to find that the crew had stolen all of their money and stores and abandoned the ship. Terrified, they could do nothing but ride out the next series of storms sent by the devils which rule the Atlantic in winter. The Palatine came to ruin just off Block Island. The shore folk bravely faced the storm to rescue the starving passengers from the wreck. Then they set fire to the ship so that it would not endanger any passing ships. But as the ship burned, the shore folk heard a wild scream. A mad woman, confined to the ship during the voyage, had been left on board. Every year since then, on the day of the tragedy, the Palatine appears off the shore and is wrecked and burned before the eyes of any who watch for her.
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.triangleReadingService.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.